Hello again, friends. This is Brian Levine. I'm your host at The Gould Standard, a regular podcast presenting fascinating conversations with remarkable artists from around the world. And today we are going to continue and complete our conversation with the one and only Viggo Mortensen. Before we do, I just wanted to remind you that you can find more information about us and more wonderful creativity at our website, www.glenngould.ca. While you're there, you'll notice the donate button. We are a registered Canadian charity, and your support would be greatly appreciated. In the meantime, for this podcast, please be sure to press like, share, and subscribe. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, please write a review. Let us know what you're thinking about what we are offering you. And now, without further ado, let us return to our conversation with Viggo Mortensen. The success of Lord of the Rings, suddenly you were vaulted to A or even triple A list category, and that meant that you could really write your own ticket. And I guess the traditional path then is to sign up for lots and lots of action adventure, big budget blockbusters, franchise films of various kinds, but you really didn't go that route. You made a different choice, which is some big budget films, yes, but a lot of more intimate, personal, thoughtful, independent films, plus spending more time on some of your other creative passions, your poetry, your painting, your music, and starting your publishing house, Perceval. By the way, for people who don't know, Perceval is Viggo's publishing house. He publishes amazing and strikingly beautiful books. I actually have a few here, and I'm, for those, when we present the video version, this is my plug for Perceval, because everyone should own at least a few Perceval Press books. This is one that actually has a relationship to Eastern Promises. It's about Russian criminal tattoo culture. Yeah. And this one is about indigenous culture.
It's about us, about Max Schmidt, who was an amazing pioneering ethnologist, anthropologist from Germany. And he was ahead of his time in his approach, and it's his photographs and his journey in the Amazon in the late 19th and early 20th century.
It's a spectacular book. This one's a little more political. And this one connects to us because we, thanks to you, got to meet Nima Nimai, the painter, the amazing Iranian painter. And
Dreams Before Extinction. Yeah, it's a beautiful book. She's a great
it
painter.
Really is.
Yeah, she was part of the jury, as you say, and when I was head of the jury, she was remarkable.
I'm still hoping one of these days we'll actually be able to present the first Canadian exhibition of her work. Her body of work has grown quite a bit since we were all together.
Yeah, I was lucky to go see an exhibition of hers, of her newer paintings in Eugene, Oregon, before the pandemic. And I hope she's one of those artists that Canadians can get the benefit of seeing her work after things return to somewhat to normal in terms of being able to visit museum spaces and galleries.
It'll happen. We just have to take our shots, be well-behaved, considerate of others. But anyway, my main point was you didn't follow the tried and true and probably, frankly, the more lucrative path. You managed to not be spending all your time on whatever the celebrity evening grist for the mill programs are, and you've been able to maintain more of your personal space. Mm-hmm. And was that a carefully thought-through decision? Do I want to go down this road, or would I rather go down the other?
Well, I've never had any kind of career plan, really. And I didn't change my approach after The Lord of the Rings came out and did so well, which changed things for all of us who were involved in that movie, opened more doors. I kept trying to find stories that might be interesting to be part of. I mean, my general approach to the stories I like to be part of, my first question is this something I'd want to go see in the movie theater, which is very subjective. And that's my approach, regardless of budget and so forth. Of course, depending on where you're at, early in your career, any experience is worthwhile. So you just need to practice. You need to do it to learn. You can only do so much classroom study and preparation for what it might be like to be in front of a camera or taking direction and all that. You have to learn by doing. And so any experience is welcome. But as you start to work, then I started to become more selective. I would just subjectively pick things that I thought, this has a chance of being a movie I'd like to go see. I can learn from this. And I think it's worthwhile. And so that's been my approach. And then it stayed the same after Lord of the Rings came out, the trilogy. But I did have more options. There were more doors to choose from.
More opportunities to turn things down.
Well, yeah, that's true. Yeah, and there's a misconception. You know, when someone gets to be relatively well-known as a director or an actor or anything else, there's this idea that, well, you can do whatever you want now, and it's up to you. And if you don't do them, well, it's your own fault and so forth. But in reality, you have always the ability, the option to say no. But to say yes, someone has to invite you. And just because you become well-known, it doesn't mean you're going to be asked to do everything. People think that, but it's not true. It is true that I had more opportunities. I was able to, David Cronenberg was able to convince his producers that, yeah, Viggo Mortensen could be someone to see for this role in History of Violence. That would have never happened before The Lord of the Rings came out and did so well. They just wouldn't have approved of me in that role. But you have to be prepared for luck. So suddenly you get called up because the third violin has come down with COVID. It's like you're called to, and if you haven't been practicing, you're not going to make much of it. So you have to keep playing that violin even when you don't have a job, and be ready for luck. You need luck to come your way. You need certain things to fall into place that you can't control. But what you can control is how ready you are to take advantage of. First of all, to recognize that there's an opportunity. If you're not prepared, you might not even recognize that there's somebody's offering you something, or life has opened a door for you. You might not even see that door.
Right. So, do you still need to go in and read for parts, or is that sort of done now?
Generally not, but sometimes more than reading, it'll be like the director may want to meet you. They want to meet you and just talk to you and have a look at you and what you look like now and what your thoughts are. You know, you might not have to read, but it's still a sort of a tryout. There's a different kind of pressure to not auditioning. If somebody offers you a part, there's a different kind of stress in that your first day of shooting is going to be your test. And so you feel, what if they've made a mistake?
Yep.
They think I'm right for this, and you know, but they may be wrong.
Yep.
So it's different. In a way, it's better to try out and earn your way in. In that sense, not that you don't earn your way in based on your body of work and people have seen you work before, but sometimes it's an unknown because I like to try different things. I like to explore stories I haven't part of before, or archetypes, characters that I hadn't played. So there's always some nervousness. You never get rid of that. I always am nervous. I mean, I'm right now in confinement, but I'm doing everything I can to prepare for this job, but it's different than any role I've played before. So I'm, you know, nervous. But being nervous is a good thing.
Before we end, I'll ask, to the extent that you're able to talk about what you're preparing for. But I do want to talk first about your work with David Cronenberg, since we've touched on it a little bit. And, of course, that consists of three films to date. Hopefully there will be more. A History of Violence, Eastern Promises, and A Dangerous Method. And these are three wildly different films in terms of their subject matter, their plots, to a certain extent, their structure. They certainly have the Cronenberg stamp on them. Do you see other connecting threads between them?
Between the three movies I've done with him? They're all quite different, I have to say. Obviously, in History of Violence and Eastern Promises, for example, the first two, identity is an important issue, and exploring, we all do that. To some degree, we're all acting. You wake up each day, and depending on who you encounter, the persona you present, the tone you use with that person, the amount of attention you give them, how you present yourself varies from person to person. It's an instinctive thing that human beings do, unless they are one of those people that we tend to call crazy, and maybe they're not at all, who walk down the street yelling out anything that comes into their mind, either because they're drunk or because there's some what we choose to see as mental imbalance. But generally speaking, people present themselves differently in different situations to different people. So those movies explored in a different way, Dangerous Method, the story of features Carl Jung and Sigmund Freud. There's also, obviously, identity is obviously very important in what they're studying and exploring. It's new science. But no, in terms of filmmaking style, I think that's one of the reasons it's difficult for David, maybe, to raise money each time out. It seems to be this huge titanic struggle, and he always ends up with less money to shoot with than he would hope.
Which is incredible. Even though, incredible.
Yeah, even though he's someone who for almost a half a century has consistently been turning in movies that do not lose money, that come in on or under budget, on or before time, he's reliable. And he always does something that's thought-provoking in his movies. He has a long record of pushing the envelope and trying different things. But for some reason, each time out, it's difficult. And maybe it's because he changes gears and tries different approaches to filmmaking. Obviously, there are certain identifiable aspects of some of his movies where they're linked, but it's more by a stylistic thing, probably has having to do with that it's usually the same cinematographer, same production designer, so forth. Not just that it's David directing them, because he does. History of Violence, Eastern Promise, and Dangerous Method, the three I've done with him, they're all quite different kinds of stories. I've said this before, that I've really enjoyed working with him, and I appreciate our friendship. The fact that he's in Falling wasn't just a gimmick or, oh, he's my friend, and wouldn't that be funny? Yeah, I've seen him act. He's good. He's very relaxed, and he happened to be perfect for that part. And I thought that he and Lance Henriksen would contrast really well.
Yes.
People, you know, and they do. They worked.
Yep, he's the model of cool, reserved professionalism as a doctor. And I'm wondering whether that's part of how he presents on the set. Is it very, yeah.
Yeah, he's very relaxed and inclusive. That idea that everybody's ideas are important. He may dismiss them out of hand with a little joke or something, but he wants them. He likes the input. He likes to see the day brings and what his team brings to the table each day. And yeah, he's somebody, his sets, in my experience, are very calm, very productive. There isn't really any shouting. Things are efficient. There's a nice atmosphere. There's humor, even in shooting the darkest scenes. People enjoy themselves working with him. So that's why he's had this loyal team of collaborators for so many years.
Yeah, I remember hearing an interview that he gave, and the question was, so you deal with such disturbing, often very deeply unsettling issues, bodies exploding, things invading the person, taking over the mind, some very strange psychosexual elements. Did you suffer some kind of terrible childhood trauma? And he said, no, I grew up in Scarborough. There was one thing. When I was 14, my dog died. So that was about it. And so my cat died. Does that mean I get to be a genius and make unforgettable films? I apparently not.
He's really been wonderful to work with, and above all, to be friends with all these years since 2004 when we met about History of Violence. And I'm hoping after this job, I'm hoping that later this summer, hopefully, we're going to be collaborating again on another
show. Oh, great. I was going to ask, because it's been a decade. It's hard to believe, yes. But it's been a decade. Now, I first became aware, actually, in connection with Eastern Promises, of your reputation for being among the most meticulously prepared actors around. That you spent time visiting Russia and getting to know members of criminal gangs to understand the tattoo culture and their approach to like their code and the code of thieves and so on. That strikes me as being both a way of, you know, protecting yourself in terms of making sure that you have technical accuracy so that no one's going to point a finger and say, that's wrong, but also potentially a gateway into entering the psyche, a kind of a physical entry point for becoming, you know, immersed in the character. Do you find that always works for you? And to what extremes have you gone to achieve that level of preparedness?
I always do that. I enjoy it, first of all. And second of all, it's a way of tempering the nerves you have, the nervousness that you have prior to shooting. When you're preparing a role, so if I'm turning over every stone and looking under it and not leaving it to chance, just guessing, I want to know all the information I can gather or invent for myself about the character I'm about to play. It's going to come to my aid somehow, I know. But most of all, it calms me down. It's like, okay, I'm doing something. I'm not waiting for this horrible day that the shoot starts and I don't know how it's going to go. I'm just memorizing my lines. No, I'm doing more than that. And the basic question I always ask myself when I'm committed to being part of a movie story, I always ask myself, what happened before page one? And you can spend the rest of your life making that up or researching it if it's a real character, or if in the script it's described something about the character's previous life. But where was the person born and what happened until page one of the script? And so that's what I do. And there are different ways of doing it. In the case of, as you say, Eastern Promises, I did work a lot with Russians and tried to get the speech down right and the tone. And in fact, we added more Russian as time went by and to the script. And I went to Russia and spent some time there, Moscow, St. Petersburg, also in the Ural region where he's meant to come from. And it was to see, just to see the landscapes, because what you in someone's eyes, what's inside their head has a lot to do with the landscapes they were brought up with. And so I wanted to see where he was from. I always want to do that if I can. And also just the way people behave, even if I didn't understand everything they were saying. What makes them laugh and what is their idea of funny and how do they interact? How do they drink together and eat together and observing? And it's a vast country and really nobody knew who I was. So it was like early days as an actor. I was able to just walk around and observe people, and people probably just assumed I was just a Russian. That was the way I looked, and I didn't stand out. I was just wearing normal clothes and I rented some shitty car in the Urals and drove around in the countryside and stuff. It was only, I think it was just the last day when I was leaving after being there a couple of weeks, where some kid pointed at me and I just saw me in a hotel lobby and he pointed at me and was looking at his mom. And I looked at him and I went, but I enjoyed it and it calmed me. So when I went back to London, where then we were about to start shooting, I had objects, I had a lot of information about the culture and about the person I was playing, who's kind of a double personality. He's pretending to be something he isn't fully, but I had angles on it when I started, and I was able to share that with the production, with Spear, with David, and the other actors, and whatever degree they were interested. But it was mostly so I would be calm and feel like I knew where I was coming from when I started to play this Russian person.
Right. But you spent some time with these guys, right?
A little bit.
Yeah. So that doesn't seem like a very calming. This one, by the way, I just happened to open to it, but it represents one of the most interesting stories for me, which is that the tattooing started back in the Gulag days during the Stalinist purges. Mm-hmm. And in prison, one of the most popular tattoos was to have Lenin, Stalin, and Marx tattooed on your chest, because when they put you up against the firing squad, they would never shoot
hard.
Exactly. So they were likely to miss. You might get a flesh wound instead of
you might survive. Yeah, that's true. Actually, it even started before that in Tsarist times, a couple hundred years ago. There's a language that these tattoos, as you know from seeing the documentary, what you wear on your body. Traditionally, now it's changed. Now people in prison there will have anything. Like, you see Polynesian tattoos, whatever you see internationally. Until maybe 20 years ago or so, there was still a strict code. What you had on your body said how many prison terms you've done, what crimes you'd committed, what your specialty as a criminal was. And if there was anything on there that was false, where you're claiming to have killed someone and you hadn't, or you're claiming to have done more prison sentences than you really had, you would be punished. You would be held down and those things would be burned or cut off you.
Oh, man.
It was kind of like your body was an open book in that sense. And there's a scene where they have me stand in front of them so they can see what I'm purporting to have done.
Right. And at the end of the film, of course, you don't really know whether his plan all along was to destroy this particular gang or to basically...
Or if he did come from that culture and then
right.
went to the other side. There's yes. a gray area. Movies that make you say, now what? Or even a piece of music that makes you feel like, okay, now what?
Exactly. We did a podcast with Tatiana Maslany, who I don't think you probably met during the film, but she's the voice of the young girl who triggers all of the action. And she, of course, went on to have a huge success with Orphan Black. And now apparently she's going to be the She-Hulk. But I always felt that the quality of her voice added a real heart and sense of conscience to that film that really kept it from becoming nihilistic and completely disillusioning, that there was something to fight for still.
Yeah, it's true. It got the movie off to a good start, too.
I've already talked a little bit about Percival Press. It's not exactly an everyday thing for someone who works in film to create a publishing house. How did that come about?
It was something I decided to do as an extension of what I was already doing, what many of us do. You read a book that you really like, and you give it to a friend who'd like this, or you recommend a movie to someone, or you have an album you like a lot and you give them that record or that CD or whatever it is, or you turn them onto it. Nowadays, I guess you say, oh, check out this link on the internet. So the idea was to create a small publishing house to publish stories that got my interest, stories that maybe wouldn't have been published otherwise or not quite in the way that that author would like. It was to find stories that I liked, subjects without a thought to genre. We publish art books, painting, poetry, photography, sometimes social commentary, anthropology, just things that interest me and haven't had an outlet at that yet. Or maybe it's an author that's been published but never had a particular type of story or subset. Or something like, for example, Mike Davis, who's a sociologist and has written a lot of important books. We published two books of his. I don't know if you have those. I can send them to you. They're essentially for adolescents. But they're great stories, Land of the Lost Mammoths and Pirates, Bats, and Dragons. And they're great. So I'll send them to you. And that was something different for him. And so we did that. And it's just to provide these things and do a nice job. Each one is tailor-made and they're designed carefully. And we make them well, so it costs money. And so we have to think carefully. We can't do that many books. And we just try to make them well, design them well, and knowing that they're going to be small print runs generally. And then the people that like them, they buy them. They go to our site, Percival Press. It's spelled the French way. I wanted it to be Percival, C-I-V-A-L, but that wasn't available, the domain name. So I chose Percival, the French spelling, and that was fine. And C-E-V-A-L. And so we've just done that. We started, especially in the early years, just to make a go of it. I would do at least one, sometimes two books of my own, photography or poetry or something, because those sold. And it was in 2002, after the first one came out. And I thought I can use the notoriety to start this little company and maybe people will buy books. And if the first one or two include a book of mine, then people will be drawn to it. And then they'll be drawn to these other artists or writers. And so that's the way it's gone. And some years we've done a lot of books, depending on how busy I am doing other things, movies and so forth. Sometimes we make a few a year, sometimes only one or two. We're reprinting and careful because I don't know how they'll do. We make small runs and sometimes they're popular and they sell out, make another run. And so we just carried on that way and looking forward to doing the one that we're going to collaborate on.
We'll hold that one in suspense for now. Folks, no, we're not going to cut it out. We're just going to leave people wondering what it's all about. What would Hitchcock do? He wouldn't give away the MacGuffin until the last reel. So you actually are playing an active role. You are essentially editor-in-chief for the press.
Yeah, each book that we make, it's always done at the same printing press, which happens to be in Spain, and it's where I've been spending a lot of time. It's a printer that I really like, and every single book, every single one we've made, I'm there for each page, just to see that, in the case of art books, photography, obviously the contrast, the color selection. You have to make some difficult decisions with art books because it's that four-color process, and you have to make compromises because it'll be on that same sheet, there'll be different paintings or different photographs, and you have to make judgment calls on the spot at the printers and get as close as you can to faithfully reproducing that person's work. And then just the inevitable typos and corrections that you make until the last moment. I know the people at that printing house, been working with them for 20 years more. Actually, the reason I knew about that place was because before starting Percival, there had been a couple of catalogs that had been made from exhibitions, photo or painting exhibitions of my own. And I'd gone on one occasion to see how that was done and to look at that in early days, venturing to say, no, that red is wrong. And if you look at this other one, I think we can. And that was the beginning of it. And since then, I'd gone. And then once we established Percival Press, I would go and make a trip to Spain and print them. And now that I spend a lot of time in Spain, it's easy. I just drive down the road and go to the place. And so I enjoy it from beginning to end, yeah. And then editing, it's you're trying to, ideally, as an editor, you know this, you're trying to not necessarily accommodate, but there's some of that. You want to be faithful to that person's tone, style. And it's a lot easier to edit other people's work than it is your own, I find, because you have objectivity. You know, I can see where you're going with this poem, but I just pose the question, maybe this poem belongs later in the book. Or maybe this poem, what if you took those three lines out, would it still do the same thing? And depending on who you're dealing with, how much experience they have, how finished the work is that they're presenting. So it's and then designing with Michelle Perez, and who's been designing all these books from the start. There's a really good collaboration there. We're tailoring each book, each publication to the artist, to the author.
That's so satisfying. Having been in the music business back before everything was streaming, the moment of excitement when a new release would arrive on our loading dock and you had a chance to really see it and imagine how people would hear it, or in your case, read it. The books are beautiful, and they do show the impulse to make each one tell its own tale in its own way, which I love it. I also love the fact that it's given me an opportunity to become more familiar with your poetry and your photography. I don't think I've seen your painting in the books yet, or maybe I've missed one. But for those of you at home, buy the books. I happen to have gotten lucky this evening, but really, it's a really worthy venture. It has tremendous artistic integrity. You will be buying a beautifully made, superior quality product. And at the very least, go check out their website, because one of the things that is exciting is it's not all of a piece. It's a wide variety of different styles and subject matters, and it's really worth exploring.
On the main page, there's new stories, there's quotes, there's sometimes I'll put a piece of music or film or book recommendations. So it's almost like this sort of a blog, but without responses to it. I just present in the same way of sharing books. I share the stories I read about, the things that have my interest at the time on that day. And we post that on a pretty much a daily basis. During the pandemic, really stepped it up and put a lot of stuff out there. But I've been doing that for years. If you want to catch up on the news, a certain angle on it in some cases.
I have huge admiration for it. But I actually want to take a little bit of a digression about a personal encounter with you that I had, and which actually was very moving for me, because it wasn't you acting in a film, and it wasn't you directing a film or creating the music for a film as you did for Falling, but actually presenting a film and talking about it. And that was Carl Theodor Dreyer's Passion of Joan of Arc, which you did at the Toronto International Film Festival's Bell Lightbox. And I found the level of engagement and appreciation. And I think that there are a lot of self-professed cineasts who kind of view watching silent film as like eating your spinach. We're past that. It's done. They had no technology. They had to do everything in the camera. The art was defined by what they didn't have, mostly sound. And of course, it grew to be a high art in a very short period of time, and then it was extinguished. And your level of, first of all, knowledge of the history of the film, the different prints of the film. And for those of you who haven't seen it, it's just, I can make an outrageous statement. You will not be a complete human being who has led a complete human life until you have seen Carl Theodor Dreyer's Passion of Joan of Arc. It's just remarkable. It's shattering.
Beautiful, beautiful movie. He was ahead of his time, certainly. And it's one of the great, you know, just for actors, if there's any actors listening, especially female actors, but anybody really, what Maria Falconetti does, this is her one movie role. Basically, she was a theater actress from France. It's astonishing. It's riveting what she does. I was talking earlier about what Lance Henriksen does in Falling, which I think is astounding as well, but in a similar way. There's no holds barred. It's raw. It's so real that it's disturbing. You know, you watch Lance and you think, I don't know if I'd want to meet him. And then you meet this generous, kind person that's an artist at the top of their form. Same thing with her. It was just extraordinary where she went. And unlike most of the performances in silent film at the time, whether it was in, you know, North American ones or European ones, even the sort of highest art, the German expressionist silent films and so forth, her acting, her immediacy, her emotional availability, the realism, the sort of the way it gets under your skin, what you're watching, the way it moves you, it was beyond anything anybody else was doing. It's one of the great performances, and in spite of it being an old way of telling stories and making movies, her performance in particular stands the test of time. You know, you can put it up next to Meryl Streep's, you know, Sophie's Choice or anything else. It's really astonishing what she does in it. And the camera moves, an unorthodox approach to camera angles and lenses and camera movement at a time when there was a lot of experimentation going on, particularly in Europe and Germany and Scandinavia, France, to some degree. Dreyer took it to another level with that movie. It's an amazing experience.
Yeah. And what I find absolutely remarkable, that if you don't have sound, dialogue, music necessarily, or at least an on-track score, then what you must have is mime, where you have to have physical action. But the film is told not 100%, but almost exclusively in close-ups. So essentially, the narrative isn't about so much the physical action and the battles and campaigns of Joan of Arc. It's about what happened after she was taken prisoner by the British and up until the time of her execution on the pyre.
The trial, essentially.
Yeah, the trial. It's the trial.
Execution. Yeah.
Yeah. It's literally...
In Danish, it's called Jeanne d'Arc's lidelse og død, meaning her passion, her suffering and death, basically. It's the trial and her end. And he shot that movie in chronological order, which is unusual. And so that I think the actress really went through the stages. And he also studied, he prepared this by looking at all the real transcripts of Joan of Arc's trial. And he selected what he wanted to use. But it's the words that are spoken with subtitles, and you see the people speaking, the questions asked and the answers given are from the transcript.
Yeah. Your illumination of that, I thought, was brilliant, and the passion. And I think it's a great message. If you think that because we have the ability to basically create never-existing creatures through computer animation, that we've reached the apex of what cinema is capable of achieving, just learn your history, look back. Not all of it's great. Like today, not all of it's great. In fact, some of it is terrible. Some of it is terrible today. But there are masterpieces, and I was wondering whether you have a few others that hold that kind of special exalted position in your pantheon, and maybe a few lines of why. Yeah, films.
There's a lot of them. There's so many. If we're talking about the silent period, a movie I like a lot is Murnau's Sunrise. It's not around that same period. That's a beautifully told story. Beautiful, beautiful. And that was the one he went and shot within the studio system in the U.S., which was great. Previously done, people know Nosferatu, his Dracula story. That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, The Last Laugh.
But there's all different, until today, there are stories that are just remarkable. And just yesterday, I rewatched a movie I hadn't seen since it came out in the year 2000. Incredible story, made against the odds, on a shoestring budget, Iranian movie called The Circle. If you can find The Circle, it's a woman's story. It's beautifully made in the sense that some movies, like, say, Nomadland this year, where there's a lot of non-actors involved, but it's extraordinary, the performances, and it gets to you. It's a great story, The Circle, for example. I'm just off the top of my head. There's so many movies that I watched many times. It's hard to just, I could give you a top 10 list, but I could also give you a top 100 list, you know, and I could change it tomorrow, you know. But there are many different genres, different styles, different nationalities. And I've been fortunate to be in some movies that I really like that I were thought-provoking at the time of making them and that I think hold up. And they're not necessarily the movies that everybody's seen. Some were presented in North America, including at Toronto Film Festival, but I would say movies. But I feel really are special stories that I've been involved with or characters that particularly were movies. Yeah. Loin des Hommes, Far From Men, French movie, which is in French and Arabic. It's one of the most beautiful stories I've been part of, I think. And I've had a chance to work with some really interesting people around the world, the Philip Ridley movies you mentioned. It's not always the thing that people recognize or has the best box office success, the things that last in memory. You only have to think back about so many movies that you end up seeing someday, and then you look into their history and you realize, oh, it didn't really get a very good reception when it came out, or there was no nominations for awards, but and yet that's probably one of the best movies made not only that year, but that decade. You know, this happens a lot.
Yeah, awards miss the best all the time.
But this happens with theater. It also happens with music. You know, people who are recognized as, at the moment, the most popular musicians or interpreters of Beethoven or Bach or whatever. And it's not always the ones that hold up. There's something else we often miss in the moment. And it's only on further reflection and with the passage of time that you realize where real value lies. During the pandemic period, I rewatched a lot of movies that I'd seen when they first came out just to see how do I feel about it now. And in some cases, you watch them again and they don't really hold up. Or I guess that was my preoccupation at the time, and I can see why I liked it, but I don't think it's very well made. Other ones are even better. There's a movie called, in English, it was called A Special Day or A Very Special Day. It's a movie that came out in 1977, an Italian movie by Ettore Scola, and it's starring Marcello Mastroianni and Sofia Loren, and it was called Una Giornata Particolare. Special Day. And it's a great story. It's about this couple. And they're not a couple, but he's a writer who's living in the same building. And Sofia Loren is the mother of several children. She's married to a guy who is a member of the fascist party. And all the kids are part of the Mussolini youth or whatever they were called. And it's the day that Hitler comes to visit. And there's a big parade. And everybody turns out either willingly or sense of obligation to be present and create these huge crowds to welcome Hitler. And you hear the radio, you hear what's going on as the woman's doing the housework. And then she looks out the window and across the way, there's a man. She's intrigued by him. And they sort of end up talking and having a somewhat of a relationship that day. And they're confined, essentially, for different reasons, both of them. And so it's almost like a pandemic or a confinement movie. And if you haven't seen A Special Day or Una Giornata Particolare, I strongly recommend it to anyone.
Two thumbs up from our resident movie critic, Viggo Mortensen. Now, I did want to ask, you have now acted in, what is it, five languages? I guess we have to count Lakota for Hidalgo, right? So my question is, perhaps not so much for the languages which aren't as familiar and conversational for you, but for ones that are, is it a different process? Is there a difference in making the different cadences and rhythms of the language work dramatically?
I find that learning it, even if you, let's say you're playing a character who is Lithuanian or whatever, and even if the film is made in English or some language other than Lithuanian, it can't hurt to learn to speak a little of the language anyway, because making the sounds of the language inevitably changes your posture, but it changes your body language. You express yourself differently. I know that from personal experience my whole life, that when I'm speaking to someone in Spanish, my tone is different, my emotional expression, I suppose, my gestures, my body language is different in Spanish than it is in English generally. And it's also different in Danish or certainly in Italian. And even within a language, when I'm in Spain speaking, they have a certain way. There are differences in the South and North. There's not one way of expressing themselves, but it's different. When I'm in Argentina or around Argentina, there's a different kind of looseness, gesture, tactile kind of thing that's somewhat even beyond Spain. Sometimes I have more of an affinity in Italy with that particular body language, but I don't know. It affects the way you. I found that once I started learning Russian, in fact, I found a teacher to help me with Eastern Promises. I knew I wouldn't be doing the whole movie in Russian, obviously, but I got the whole thing translated into Russian and learned how to say everything.
Amazing.
Just to see what that would be like. And how did I carry myself? How would I tell a joke or understand something or double entendres and so forth? It just changes the way you behave, the way you present yourself, depending on the language. Just as a musician, let's say you're playing jazz or rhythm and blues or classical music, you're emotionally, you're presenting yourself in a different way, even physically sometimes. And your body language changes. I find that fascinating. And it's easier to learn those things if you actually like it and it's not just a chore. Obviously, any subject that you have a teacher that inspires you, where you enjoy what you're learning, you're going to learn quicker and you're going to retain that information. It's not going to be, okay, I have to learn this. And then 3 months after the exams, they ask you the question, you have no idea what the answer is. But if you've enjoyed it, you're like, yeah, no, I could give you an answer.
That really resonates with me. When Jessie Norman was in Toronto for the Glenn Gould Prize, she did a master class at the University of Toronto Faculty of Music, and she worked with 6 or 7 very good singers. And there were actually some critiques of her. All she did was zoom in on pronunciation. These are texts in French and Italian and in German. And it was mostly art song or Lieder, which is, for those who haven't spent time with it, it's like opera in miniature under a microscope, a single poem set by a great composer in a way that's designed to bring out every nuance of the text. She was very meticulous about this. Everything that is in the musical line grows out of that text. This text existed first. The composer said it, which meant that these two cannot be separated from each other. And the rhythms and the rises and falls of the musical line are totally in the words.
Yeah, I think that's makes me think of each beat of each story, each piece of music has its own set of problems, mysteries that you have to unlock. And the more you dig in, the more problems, the more details there are. And it can scare you, but it's if you enjoy the process, you will keep mining it. And that's why when you see different representations by singers, by conductors, by musicians, I've heard that sonata 500 times. I've never heard it like that. They found something else. And it makes me think about something that H.L. Mencken said one time. He said, for every complex problem, there is a simple, clear, and wrong answer.
Absolutely. And let's face it, we as a species, knowing that we have only so much time on Earth, are addicted to oversimplifying, as a way of creating a shortcut from here to there.
Yeah, and in modern technology, people are less patient with movie stories and music and sitting at a concert and listening to a long opera, whatever it is, or even listening to a short one. But people have less tolerance. And so image-wise, what they see on their phones, give me the gist of the story. That's all I want.
Right.
And then I'll decide what I make of it. That's fair.
Exactly. Or I'm giving away free money. How much of this $1 million would you like me not to give you? I did want to ask about two of your other more recent films. First of all, Captain Fantastic, because I love the film. Although the character Ben Cash isn't really out of the 60s, but there's a certain 60s ethos that he embodies. And we don't find all of the pain and trauma that explains much of his behavior with his children. But it is also a clash of cultures between the socially acceptable, materially successful North American lifestyle, the success that we all are supposed to aspire to, and the road less taken. There are some political elements in it that I find tantalizing and evocative, including Noam Chomsky Day, and also in an indirect way how we first met, that Glenn Gould does make an appearance or two in the course of the film in a very moving way. I wondered whether you might have had anything to do with that and asked a friend who, you know, who connected us, and hence we struck up the conversation for the jury, and the rest of they say is hysteria. And but did you find something that resonated very personally with you?
No, the inclusion of Bach or of Glenn Gould's particular rendition of the Goldberg Variations, that was in the script. I like his interpretation of that music a lot. And Matt Ross, who the writer-director of the movie, is he's someone you'd enjoy talking to. He's very intelligent, very thoughtful, good sense of humor, and he really did a great job of preparing. He was the perfect example of how to prepare a shoot, because we didn't have many. We had 30-odd days to shoot the whole thing, and changing locations all the time, and kids with limited working hours. It was a tall order to get that done. But he prepared it in an excellent way, an inclusive way, and everybody felt part of the storytelling, and everybody's opinions mattered at all times. He put it into practice on a daily basis. So it was a great collective movie-making experience. And I thought it was a great script. It was very intelligent, thought-provoking, funny sometimes. I like the outdoors. I really like being in nature a lot. I always have, and it's one of the things, the pandemic that has been difficult for me. In fact, where I got stuck when it first started was in an apartment, and did have some windows, real tiny step out, not really a full balcony. And so I started I had seeds that I'd saved up and I wasn't going to plant there, but I started planting tomatoes and potatoes and whatever. I thought, I don't know how long we're going to be here. I enjoy being in the outdoors. And I like the approach to culture. Maybe it's pretty strict in a way and over the top, the way Ben Cash raises his kids, but the things they read, the discussions they have, and the everybody's opinion counts approach to these family gatherings and their routines, I thought was amazing. A lot of people were inspired by that and have still talked to me about, I want to do that with my kids. We really need to read more. We need to share what we're reading and music. And, you know, it's ideal. Who has time for all that, you might say, but you can make time. Like, it's not like you're forced to not have time. Yes, everybody has, especially these days, it's getting more and more tricky. How do you make ends meet? How do you pay your rent? You can't go to work. It's just tough. For a lot of people are really in big trouble. But sometimes you do have moments that you can fill, and you can fill by just looking at the sky or doing nothing or being on your phone and scrolling through things that are just like, I guess, superficial, passing interest. They're not going to really instruct you in how to look at the world or look inside yourself. And obviously the Cash family makes a conscious effort to examine everything, to question everything, essentially, and to not be afraid of making mistakes and learning from them. I could bring that to Glenn Gould. I love, one of my favorite things was where he said something to the effect that, you know, that he's made mistakes in the sense that he's gone through numerous red lights in his life and paid the consequences, but he's also stopped at a lot of green lights and never gotten credit for that.
That's right. Well, that just goes to show that sometimes our greatest achievements are the ones we receive no credit for. And that brings us to the end of our special two-part conversation with Viggo Mortensen. We're so glad that he was able to join us and spend the time with us. And Olivia, wasn't that absolutely remarkable to hear about all the different creative avenues he's pursued since his time as Aragorn in Lord of the Rings?
Absolutely. Just the career that Viggo has had is just absolutely astonishing, and he still continues to create beautiful art in so many different mediums. So we're very lucky to have him as a guest and also as a member of our board of directors here at the Glenn Gould Foundation.
We are fortunate indeed. And I hope all of you friends will take the opportunity to seek out Vigo's directorial debut, the remarkable film Falling. As well, if you love the feeling of fine paper beneath your fingertips, check out books from his publishing house, Percival Press. They are very special indeed. And his music with Buckethead, all available if you care to find them, as well as his numerous extraordinary roles. And we will, of course, in the weeks to come, have more extraordinary guests. But in the meantime, Olivia, I understand you have some absolutely vital information to impart to our friends.
Absolutely. If you enjoyed this two-part feature with Viggo Mortensen, we certainly have much more for you here at the Gould Standard. So I'd encourage you to subscribe either on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you care to keep up with the Glenn Gould Foundation, you can find us across social media and, of course, on our website, www.glenngould.ca. And as a registered Canadian charity, of course, we appreciate gifts of all sizes, amounts. It's really the thought that counts, and we appreciate every little bit.
Yea, verily, no truer word was ever spoken. And while I'm exploring the expressions of past eras, I seem to hear another one of them approaching our studio. Who could it be?
Take it away, Mr. Edison.